Chapter 3. Antitheistic Theories. Section 1. What is meant by antitheism? As theism is the doctrine of an extramundane, personal God, the creator, preserver, and governor of all things, any doctrine which denies the existence of such a being is antitheistic. Not only avowed atheism, therefore, but polytheism, hylozoism, materialism, and pantheism, belong to the class of antitheistic theories. Atheism. Atheism does not call for any separate discussion. It is in itself purely negative. It affirms nothing. It simply denies what theism asserts. The proof of theism is, therefore, the refutation of atheism. Atheist is, however, a term of reproach. Few men are willing to call themselves, or to allow others to call them by that name. Hume, we know, resented it. Hence those who are really atheists, according to the etymological and commonly received meaning of the word, repudiate the term. They claim to be believers in God, although they assign to that word a meaning which is entirely unauthorized by usage. Thus Helvetius 167 says, "There is no man of understanding who does not admit an active principle in nature. Therefore there is no atheist. He is not an atheist who says that motion is God. Because in fact motion is incomprehensible, as we have no clear idea of it, because it only manifests itself by its effects, and by it all things are performed in the universe." Cousin 168 says, "Atheism is impossible, because the existence of God is implied in every affirmation. If a man believes that he exists, he must believe in the power of thought, and that is God." In like manner Herbert Spencer claims to be religious. He does not oppose religion, but dogmas. He acknowledges inscrutable power. He reduces all our knowledge to the two facts, that force is, and force is persistent. Force, however, is perfectly inscrutable and incomprehensible. On this principle he attempts to reconcile religion and science. The ultimate principle of religion, that on which all religions agree, is that there is an inscrutable power which is the cause of all things. This also is the ultimate principle of science. They have therefore a common ground. Nothing can be predicated of this cause. Not consciousness. Not intelligence. Not will. Only that it is a force. This is all the God the new philosophy leaves us. 169. Language, however, has its rights. The meaning of words cannot be changed at the pleasure of individuals. The word God, and its equivalents in other languages, have a definite meaning, from which no man is at liberty to depart. If anyone says he believes in God, he says he believes in the existence of a personal, self-conscious being. He does not believe in God, if he only believes in motion, in force, in thought, in moral order, in the incomprehensible, or in any other abstraction. Theists also have their rights. Theism is a definite form of belief. For the expression of that belief, the word theism is the established and universally recognized term. We have the right to retain it. And we have the right to designate as atheism all forms of doctrine which involve the denial of what is universally understood by theism. Is atheism possible? The question has often been discussed, whether atheism is possible? The answer to the question depends on the meaning of the term. If the question be, whether a man can emancipate himself from the conviction that there is a personal being to whom he is responsible for his character and conduct, and who will punish him for his sins, it must be answered in the negative. For that would be to emancipate himself from the moral law, which is impossible. If, however, the question means, whether a man may, by speculation or otherwise, bring himself into such a state as to lose the consciousness of the belief of God as written in his heart, and free himself, for a time, from its power? It must be answered affirmatively. A man may, in this sense, deny his individuality or identity. The real, objective existence of soul or body, mind or matter. The distinction between right and wrong. But this is unnatural, and cannot last. It is like deflecting the spring by force. The moment the force is removed, the spring returns to its normal position. Men, therefore, often pass in a moment from a state of entire skepticism to a state of unquestioning faith. Not, of course, by a process of argument, but by a change in their inward state. This transition from unbelief to faith, though thus sudden, and although not produced by an intellectual process, is perfectly rational. The feelings which rise in the mind contain evidence of the truth which the understanding cannot resist. It is also a familiar psychological fact that skepticism and faith may, in a certain sense, coexist in the mind. An idealist, while abiding by his theory, has nevertheless an inward conviction of the reality of the external world. So the speculative atheist lives with the abiding conviction that there is a God to whom he must render an account. Section 2. Polytheism. As the word implies, polytheism is the theory which assumes the existence of many gods. Monotheism was the original religion of our race. This is evident not only from the teachings of the scriptures, but also from the fact that the earliest historical form of religious belief is monotheistic. There are monotheistic hymns in the Vedas, the most ancient writings now extant, unless the Pentateuch be an exception. The first departure from monotheism seems to have been nature worship. As men lost the knowledge of God as creator, they were led to reverence the physical elements with which they were in conflict, whose power they witnessed, and whose beneficent influence they constantly experienced. Hence not only the sun, moon, and stars, the great representatives of nature, but fire, air, and water, became the objects of popular worship. We accordingly find that the Vedas consist largely of hymns addressed to these natural elements. These powers were personified, and soon it came to be generally believed that a personal being presided over each. And these imaginary beings were the objects of popular worship. While the mass of the people really believed in beings that were called gods, 1 Corinthians 8:5, many of the more enlightened were monotheists, and more were pantheists. The early introduction and wide dissemination of pantheism are proved from the fact that it lies at the foundation of Brahmanism and Buddhism, the religions of the larger part of the human race for thousands of years. There can be little doubt that when the Aryan tribes entered India, 1500 or 2000 years before Christ, pantheism was their established belief. The unknown and unconditioned infinite being reveals itself according to the Hindu system as Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, that is, as creator, preserver, and restorer. These were not persons, but modes of manifestation. It was in this form that the idea of an endless process of development of the infinite into the finite, and of the return of the finite into the infinite, was expressed. It was from this pantheistic principle that the endless polytheism of the Hindus naturally developed itself. And this determined the character of their whole religion. As all that is only a manifestation of God, everything remarkable, and especially the appearance of any remarkable man, was regarded as an avatar, or incarnation of God, in one or other of his modes of manifestation, as Brahma, Vishnu, or Shiva. And as evil is as actual as good, the one is as much a manifestation, or modus existendi, of the infinite being as the other. And hence there are evil gods as well as good. In no part of the world has pantheism had such a field for development as in India, and nowhere has it brought forth its legitimate effects in such a portentous amount of evil. Nowhere has polytheism been carried to such revolting extremes. Among the Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans, polytheism assumed a form determined by the character of the people. The Greeks rendered it bright, beautiful, and sensual. The Romans were more decorous and sedate. Among barbarous nations it has assumed forms much more simple, and in many cases more rational. In the Bible the gods of the heathen are declared to be vanity, and nothing, mere imaginary beings, without power either to hurt or to save. Jeremiah 2:28, Isaiah 41:29, 42:17, Psalm 106:28. They are also represented as daemonia, 1 Corinthians 10:20. This word may express either an imaginary or a real existence. The objects of heathen worship are called gods, even when declared to be non-entities. So they may be called demons, without intending to teach that they are spirits. As the word, however, generally in the New Testament, does mean evil spirits, it is perhaps better to take it in that sense when it refers to the objects of heathen worship. This is not inconsistent with the doctrine that the gods of the heathen are vanities and lies. They are not what men take them to be. They have no divine power. Paul says of the heathen before their conversion, Edelus etois fusemi ausi boi Galatians 4:8. The prevalence and persistency of polytheism show that it must have a strong affinity with fallen human nature. Although, except in pantheism, it has no philosophical basis, it constitutes a formidable obstacle to the progress of true religion in the world. Section 3. Hylozoism. Hylozoism, from hyle, matter, and zoe, life, is properly the doctrine that matter is endued with life, and this is the form in which the doctrine was held by many of its advocates. All matter, and every particle of matter, besides its physical properties, has a principle of life in itself, which precludes the necessity of assuming any other cause for the phenomena of life exhibited in the world. In this form, hylozoism does not differ from materialism. Most commonly, however, the term is used to designate a system which admits a distinction between mind and matter, but considers them as intimately and inseparably united, as the soul and body in man. God, according to this view, is the soul of the world. An intelligent power everywhere present, to which are to be referred all the manifestations of design in the external world, and all the activity of the human soul. The relation, however, of the soul to the body, is a very imperfect illustration of the relation of God to the world according to the hylozoistic system. The soul is really exterior to the body, and independent of it, at least for its existence and activity. It is not the life of the body. It neither fashions nor preserves it. It is not even conscious of the vital activity by which the body is developed and sustained. Whereas according to the hylozoistic theory, the soul of the world is its plastic principle, the inward source of all its organizations and of all its activities. The leading principles of this theory as developed by the Stoics are, 1. There are two constituent principles of the universe, one active, the other passive. The passive principle is matter, without form and without properties, that is inert. The active principle is mind, dwelling in matter its organizing formative power, that is God too. The universe is therefore to be viewed under three aspects: a. As the all-forming power, the natural natrons, or, he fusses technite. B. The world is formed by this living, inward principle, the living cosmos, or natural naturata. C. The identity of the two, as they form one whole. It is only by an act of the mind that the one is distinguished from the other. Therefore the world, as including both, or as the identity of both, is formed with the greatest wisdom, and by a necessary process, for the laws of nature are the laws of reason. Cicero, 170, expounding this system, says, Natura, non artificosa solum, sed plain artifex abiotum zenon dissiter. Consul tricks, et provide utilitatum opportunitatum omnium. Sensit zeno enim artis maxim proprium est creare et gigner. Quod in operibus nostrum artium manus officit id multo artificosius naturam officer. 3. The universe, therefore the all-one, of which God is the soul and nature the body, is living, immortal, rational, and perfect zoon affinitum, logikon, teleion. God, as the controlling, operative principle in all things, acts according to necessary although rational laws. 4. The souls of men are of the same nature with the soul of the world, but as individual existences, passing away when the life of the body ceases. 5. The highest end of life is virtue. And virtue is living according to reason. 171. This system in one of its forms is nearly identical with materialism, and in the other with pantheism. There is no personal God to whom we are responsible, no freedom of the will. Therefore, no sin, and no conscious existence after death. Section 4. Materialism. Materialism is that system which ignores the distinction between matter and mind, and refers all the phenomena of the world, whether physical, vital, or mental, to the functions of matter. A. The doctrine of Epicurus. Epicurus taught, 1. That as ex nihilo nihil fit, the universe has always existed, and must continue to exist forever. 2. that space, and the number of bodies which it contains, are infinite. 3. These bodies are of two kinds, simple and compound. The simple bodies are atoms possessing form, magnitude, and weight. They are indivisible, unalterable, and indestructible. This is also the doctrine of modern science. Faraday 172 says, "A particle of oxygen is ever a particle of oxygen, nothing can in the least wear it. If it enters into combination, and disappears as oxygen. If it passed through 1,000 combinations, animal, vegetable, and mineral, if it lie hid for 1,000 years, and then be evolved, it is oxygen with its first qualities, neither more nor less. It has all its original force, and only that. The amount of force which it disengaged when hiding itself, has again to be employed in a reverse direction when it is set at liberty. 4. These atoms have their peculiar forces, distinct from the mere gravity. This, too, is the doctrine of modern science. It is included in what Faraday says in the passage just quoted. Molecules, say the scientific men of our day, have been endowed with forces which give rise to various chemical qualities, and these never change either in their nature or in their amount. 173.5. Epicurus taught that the quantity of matter, and of course the amount of force in the world, is always the same, neither can be increased or diminished. 6. The atoms, of which the number is infinite, move through space with incredible velocity under the guidance of necessary physical laws. 7. By the combination of these atoms under the influence of gravity and other physical forces, the universe was formed, and became a cosmos. This is very nearly the nebular hypothesis. 8. The soul is material. Or, in other words, all mental phenomena are due to the properties of matter. This, also, is proclaimed as the last result of modern science. 9. The soul, of course, ceases to exist when the body dies. That is, as death is the cessation of the vital, so it is also of the intellectual functions of the individual. The atoms of which the man is composed, with the forces which belong to them, continue to exist, and may enter into the composition of other men. But the man, as an individual, ceases to exist. This, almost in so many words, is the avowed doctrine of many physicists of the present day. 10. Sensation is for us the only source of knowledge. By remembering former sensations, we form ideas, and by the combination of ideas we form judgments. Almost the very words of Hume, and the doctrine of the whole school of which he is the representative. 11. As Epicurus held that nothing is incorporeal except a vacuum, he of necessity includes all the forms of existence under the head of matter. As there is no mind or spirit, there is no God, and no moral law. Virtue is only a prudent regard to happiness. In a certain sense he admitted the existence of gods, but they were corporeal beings having no concern with the affairs of men. 174. A recent German writer, 175 inches Herzog's Encyclopae, under the head of materialismus, says that notwithstanding the great progress of modern science, the materialists of our day have not advanced a step upon the system of Epicurus. Its system, probably owing to the dominant influence of the higher philosophy of Plato and Aristotle, did not exert much influence on the ancient mind, or on the progress of human thought. It was not until modern times that materialism gained any great power as a philosophical theory. Be materialism in England during the 18th century. Hobbes 1588-1679 anticipated the movement towards materialism which manifested itself in England during the last century. He made sensation the real basis of every mental operations, the sole originator of our ideas, the sole medium and test of truth. 176 As, therefore, we can perceive through sensation only what is material, he concluded that matter is the only reality, and that whatever exists to us must accordingly be a part of the material universe. The whole process of scientific investigation was thus reduced to the doctrine of bodies, beyond which, he maintained, there can be no knowledge whatever accessible to the human mind. This knowledge, however, does not refer simply to the existence of bodies, but also to their changes, of all which changes the ultimate principle is motion. The doctrine of bodies, therefore, includes the knowledge of all phenomena in relation to their probable causes, and of all possible causes as known from their observed effects, the mind itself he viewed as wholly material, the phenomena of consciousness being the direct result of our organization. The one great and fundamental fact of mind is sensation, which is nothing more or less than the effect of material objects around us, exerted by means of pressure or impact upon that material organization which we term the mind. 177 Thus it appears that Hobbes anticipated the great result of modern science, that all force may be resolved into motion. Locke 1632-1704. The introduction of materialism into England during the last century is generally attributed to the influence of Locke's philosophy. Locke himself was far from being a materialist, and the advocates of his system strenuously insist that his principles have no legitimate tendency to obliterate the distinction between matter and mind. Locke, however, in combating the doctrine of innate ideas, in the sense of abstract truths, seemed to deny that the mind was so constituted as to apprehend truth intuitively, and beyond the range of experience. He compared the mind to a tabula rasa. This figure suggests that all our knowledge is from without, as the slate contributes nothing to the matter written upon it. He defined ideas to be anything with which the mind is immediately occupied when we think. The origin of these ideas, he said, was sensation and reflection. If by reflection he meant the observation of the phenomena of the mind, his theory is one thing. If it mean the process of recalling, combining, analyzing, and otherwise elaborating the impressions upon us from without, his theory is another. Probably Locke himself, and certainly many of his followers, took it in the latter sense. And thus the two sources of ideas, or of knowledge, are reduced to one, and that one is sensation. But as sensation can give us the knowledge only of what is external and material, the theory in this form seemed to leave no room for the higher ideas of eternal and necessary truths. Locke attempts to account for our ideas of time, space, infinity, cause, and even of right and wrong, from observation, that is from observation of what is without, or from impressions made upon our senses. It is a common criticism upon Locke's great work, that in it he does not distinguish between the occasion and the source of our ideas. Our experience furnishes the occasion, and it may be the necessary condition, of waking the mind to the perception not only of the fact experience, but also of the intuitive apprehension of the universal and necessary truth which the fact involves. If we did not see effects produced around us, and did not ourselves exercise efficiency, we might never have the idea of causation. But the conviction that every effect must have a cause is an intuitive judgment, which experience can neither produce nor limit. It is not from the observed tendency of some acts to produce happiness, and of others to produce misery, that we get the idea of the essential distinction between right and wrong, but from the constitution of the mind. Although Locke, and many of his disciples, were satisfied with his method of accounting for our ideas of God, of spirit, and of moral and religious truths, yet it is also certain that many of his followers felt justified on his principles to discard them. Hartley 1705-1757. Hartley was a physician and a physiologist. Physiology and psychology have intimate relations. It is perhaps natural that those who devote themselves specially to the former should make little of the latter. It is the marked characteristic of our age, so far as physicists are concerned, that it tries to merge psychology entirely into physiology. Hartley adopted the principles of Locke, and endeavored to show how it is that external things produce sensation and thought. This he did by his theory of vibrations. The objects of the external world affect in some manner the extreme ends of the nerves, which spread from the brain as center to every part of the body. This affection produces a vibration, which is continued along the nerve by the agency of an elastic ether, until it reaches the brain, where it constitutes the phenomenon we term sensation. When a sensation has been experienced several times, the vibratory movement from which it arises acquires the tendency to repeat itself spontaneously, even when the external object is not present. These repetitions or relics of sensations are ideas, which in their turn possess the property of recalling each other by virtue of mutual association among themselves. 178 This doctrine of association of ideas is the most important part of his system. He insists principally on the following law: an idea is sometimes associated with another through the medium of a third. But in process of time this intermediate idea may be disregarded, and yet the connection between the first and third may, notwithstanding, remain. Thus the idea of pleasure, which is so indissolubly connected with money, arises from the conveniences which it is able to procure, while in the mind of the miser the conveniences are lost sight of, and the very possession of the money itself is regarded as containing the whole enjoyment. In this way hardly accounts for almost all the emotions and passions of the human mind. The domestic affections, for instance, arise from the transference of the pleasure derived from parental kindness to the parent itself. The social and patriotic affections from transferring the pleasures of society to the country which affords them. In like manner, also, the moral and religious affections, the love of virtue and the love of God, arise from the pleasures connected with virtuous and pious conduct, being transferred to the law of action, or to the supreme lawgiver, from whom these pleasures have emanated. 179. The connection of this theory with materialism is obvious. If vibrations of the brain constitute sensation, and if the relics, or spontaneous repetitions of these vibrations constitute thought and feeling, then all mental and moral acts are mere affections of our material organism. It is also obvious that, according to this theory, there is no more freedom in volition than in sensation. The former is a mode, or relic of the latter. Although this tendency of his system was undeniable, and although his successors drew these conclusions from his principles, Hartley himself was not a materialist. He was a very religious man. It is not at all uncommon for a man to hold a speculative theory inconsistent with his faith. Moral 180 quotes the following criticism of Hartley's doctrine from the Edinburgh Review. There may be, says the reviewer, little shakings in the brain, for anything we know, and there may even be shakings of a different kind accompanying every act of thought or perception. But that the shakings themselves are the thought or perception, we are so far from admitting, that we find it absolutely impossible to comprehend what is meant by the assertion. The shakings are certain throbbings, vibrations, or stirrings, in a whitish, half-fluid substance like custard, which we might see perhaps, or feel, if we had eyes and fingers sufficiently small or fine for the office. But what should we see or feel, upon the supposition that we could detect by our senses, everything that actually took place in the brain? We should see the particles of this substance change their place a little, move a little up or down, to the right or the left, roundabout or zigzag, or in some other course or direction. This is all that we could see, if Dr. Hartley's conjecture were proved by actual observation. Because this is all that exists in motion, according to our conception of it, and all that we mean when we say that there is motion in any substance. Is it intelligible, then, to say, that this motion, the whole of which we see and comprehend, is thought and feeling, and that thought and feeling will exist, wherever we can excite a similar motion in a similar substance? In our humble apprehension the proposition is not so much false, as utterly unmeaning and incomprehensible. 181. If history repeats itself, so does philosophy. What the Edinburgh Review said of Hartley nearly 70 years ago, Professor Tyndall says of the materialists of our day. The passage from the physics of the brain to the corresponding facts of consciousness is unthinkable. Granted that a definite thought and a definite molecular action in the brain occur simultaneously. We do not possess the intellectual organ, nor apparently any rudiment of the organ, which would enable us to pass, by a process of reasoning, from the one phenomenon to the other. They appear together, but we do not know why. Were our minds and senses so expanded, strengthened, and illuminated, as to enable us to see and feel the very molecules of the brain? Were we capable of following all their motions, all their grouping, all their electric discharges, if such there be? And were we intimately acquainted with the corresponding states of thought and feeling, we should probably be as far as ever from the solution of the problem. How are these physical processes connected with the facts of consciousness? The chasm between the two classes of phenomena would still remain intellectually impassable. Let the consciousness of Luz, for example, be associated with the right-handed spiral motion of the molecules of the brain, and the consciousness of hate with the left-handed spiral motion. We should then know when we love that the motion is in one direction, and when we hate that the motion is in the other, but the why would still remain unanswered. In affirming that the growth of the body is mechanical, and that thought, as exercised by us, has its correlative in the physics of the brain, I think the position of the materialist is stated as far as that position is a tenable one. I think the materialist will be able finally to maintain this position against all attacks. But I do not think, as the human mind is at present constituted, that he can pass beyond it. I do not think he is entitled to say that his molecular grouping and his molecular motions explain everything. In reality, they explain nothing. 182. Priestley 1733-1804. Priestley owes his permanent reputation to his important discoveries in the department of physical science. He was, however, prominent during his life for the part he took in philosophical and theological controversies. Devoted to science, the senses were for him the great sources of knowledge. All others, except supernatural eye revelation which he admitted, he distrusted. He adopted with enthusiasm the theory of Hartley which resolved thought and feeling into vibrations of the brain. Hartley, he said, had done more for the doctrine of mind than Newton accomplished for the theory of the material universe. He did not hesitate to avow himself a materialist. Priestley, says Morrill, 183 rested the truth of materialism upon two deductions. The first was, that thought and sensation are essentially the same thing, that the whole variety of our ideas, however abstract and refined they may become, are, nevertheless, but modifications of the sensational faculty. The second deduction was, that all sensation, and, consequently, all thought, arises from the affections of our material organization, and therefore consists entirely in the motion of the material particles of which the nerves and brain are composed. He was a necessitarian, and in morals a utilitarian. Believing, however, in God and in divine revelation, he admitted a future state of existence. As the Bible teaches the doctrine of the resurrection of the body, Priestley believed that man would be restored to conscious existence when that event occurred. His principal works bearing on the subject are Examination of Reed, Beattie, and Oswald, Doctrine of Philosophical Necessity Explained, Disquisitions Relating to Matter and Spirit, and Hartley's Theory of the Human Mind, with essays relating to the subject of it. Hume was regarded as their master by the most advanced physicists of the modern scientific school, so far as their general principles and method of philosophizing are concerned. He was neither a materialist nor an idealist, but rather a nihilist, as his great object was to show that no certainty could be attained in any department of knowledge. He affirmed nothing and denied everything. Such knowledge as we have comes from sensation. Therefore, he maintained that as we have no sensation of efficiency, we can have no idea of it, and no evidence of its reality. A cause is not that which produces an effect, but simply that which uniformly precedes it. Consequently, anything can be the cause of anything. Again, as we have no perception by the senses of substance, there can be no such thing. This applies to mind as well as matter. Nothing exists to us but our thoughts and feelings. We are nothing but a bundle or collection of different perceptions, which succeed each other with an inconceivable rapidity, and are in perpetual flux and movement. 100. Materialism in France during the 18th century. The sensational philosophy, as it is called, found a much more congenial soil in France than in England. Locke's essay was translated into the language of that country and made the subject of comments and lectures. His leading principles were adopted without the limitations and qualifications with which he had presented them, and conclusions drawn from them which Locke would have been the first to repudiate. Condillac, one of the first and most influential of the disciples of Locke, in his first work, Essai sur l'origine des connaissances humaines, differed comparatively little from the English philosopher. But in his trait des sensations, he virtually discarded reflection as a source of our ideas, and regarded all thoughts, feelings, and volitions as transformed sensations. While he answered the question concerning the relation between the soul and body, by assuming their identity, he took this the ground in accounting for the origin of the world. This middle ground was occupied also, at least ostensibly, by Diderot and D'Alembert in the French Encyclopédie, who, notwithstanding their sensational theory as to the source of our knowledge, and they're making happiness the ground of morals and end of life, not only maintain mystic principles, but insisted on the necessity of a divine revelation. This, however, was probably more a matter of prudence than of conviction. 184. These, however, were only the first steps. The extreme of materialistic atheism was soon reached and avowed. La Mettrie published his L'Histoire naturelle de l'Homme in 1745, his L'Homme Machine, the same year, and his L'Homme Plant in 1749. Helvetius published his work De L'Esprit in 1758. His book entitled De L'Homme was published after his death. The climax was reached by Baron de Holbach in his Cyst et de la Nature, in which materialism, fatalism, and atheism were openly avowed. According to this system, matter and emotion are eternal. Thought is an agitation of the nerves. The soul the result of our corporeal organization. The will the strongest sensation. The ground of morals a regard to our own happiness. There is no freedom, no morality, no future existence, no God. When these principles got hold of the popular mind, then came the end. D-positivism. Quant, the author of the positive philosophy, was born in 1798, and died in 1859. The greater part of his life was passed in poverty and neglect. His only occupation was teaching. 10 years were devoted to the preparation of a course of lectures on philosophy which secured them wealth and fame. He called the system philosophy positive, because it purported to assume nothing beyond the content of observed facts. The fundamental principle of the positive philosophy is the one so often referred to, namely, that the senses are the only source of our knowledge, hence nothing exists but matter. There is no mind distinct from matter. No such thing as efficiency. No causes, whether first or final. No God. No future state of existence for man. Theology and psychology are, therefore, banished from the domain of science. Science is solely occupied in the observation of facts, and in deducing from them the laws by which they are determined. These laws, however, are not forces operating in a uniform manner, but simply statements of the actual order in the sequence of events. The sequence is not only uniform but necessary. Our business is simply to ascertain what it is. The only method by which this can be done is observation. This task is much easier in some departments than in others. For in some the facts to be observed are less numerous and less complicated. In mathematics and astronomy the facts are all of one kind. Whereas in physiology and sociology they are very different kinds, and vastly more complicated. The same rule, however, applies to all departments. In all, the sequence of events is uniform and necessary. And if we can only, by a sufficient induction of facts, ascertain what the law of sequence is, we shall be able to predict the future as certainly in one department as in another. The astronomer can tell what will be the position of the stars and planets a century hence. The positivist will be able to foretell with equal certainty how a man will act in any given circumstances, and what will be the progress and state of society in time to come. It follows, therefore, according to the positive philosophy, 1. That all our knowledge is confined to physical phenomena. 2. That all we can know of such phenomena is, that they are, and the relations in which they stand to each other. 3. That these relations are all included under the heads of sequence and resemblance. 4. These relations constitute the laws of nature, and are invariable. 5. As everything that exists is material, these laws, or invariable relations of succession and resemblance, control all the phenomena of mind, as we call it, and of social life and of history, as well as those of nature, in the common sense of that word. 6. As everything is included in the department of physics, everything is controlled by physical laws, and there is no more freedom in human acts than in the motions of the stars. And, therefore, the one can be predicted with the same certainty as the other. The following quotations from the philosophy positive, freely translated and condensed by Harriet Martineau, 185, include all the points above mentioned. The first characteristic of the positive philosophy is that it regards all phenomena as subjected to invariable natural laws. Our business is, seeing how vain is any research into what are called causes, whether first or final, to pursue an accurate discovery of these laws, with a view to reducing them to the smallest possible number. 186. Our positive method of connecting phenomena is by one or other of two relations, that of similitude or that of succession, the mere fact of such resemblance or succession being all that we can pretend to know, and all that we need to know. For this perception comprehends all knowledge which consists in elucidating something by something else, in now explaining, and now foreseeing certain phenomena, by means of the resemblance or sequence of other phenomena. 187. If we regard these functions of the mind under their statical aspect, that is, if we consider the conditions under which they exist, we must determine the organic circumstances of the case, which inquiry involves it with anatomy and physiology. If we look at the dynamic aspect, we have to study simply the exercise and results of the intellectual powers of the human race, which is neither more nor less than the general object of the positive philosophy. Vol. 1 pages 11. 188. Kant is obliged to use the word power, and to speak of its exercise, yet all his philosophy denies the existence of any such thing as efficiency. The laws which determine events are nothing more than facts of uniform sequence. According to the passage just quoted, one department of psychology, the statical, belongs to anatomy and physiology. The other, the dynamic, to the observed sequence of certain facts called intellectual. The sequence is invariable. The intervention of will is necessarily excluded, because philosophy, at least positivism, is nothing unless it secures the power of revision. But free acts cannot be foreseen by man. Hence Kant says, the arbitrary can never be excluded while political phenomena are referred to will, divine or human, instead of being connected with invariable natural laws. 189. If social events were always exposed to disturbance by the accidental intervention of the legislator, human or divine, no scientific provision of them would be possible. 190. Intellectual exercises being regarded as a function of the brain, Kant says, the positive theory of the intellectual and affective functions is therefore henceforth unchangeably regarded as consisting in the study, both rational and experimental, of the various phenomena of internal sensibility, which are proper to the cerebral ganglia, apart from their external apparatus. It is, therefore, simply a prolongation of animal physiology, properly so called, when this is extended so as to include the fundamental and ultimate attributes. 191. Kant, being an ardent phrenologist, founded one of the arguments for a system on the organization of the brain. But his great dependence was upon the law of human development. He admitted no essential difference between man and irrational animals. The superiority of man is only in the degree of his intelligence, which is due to his better physical organization. According to Kant, the whole human race, and every individual man, passes through three distinct stages, which he calls the theological, the metaphysical, and the positive. During the first stage, all events are referred to supernatural causes. In the first part of this stage of their progress, men were fetish worshippers. Then they gradually became polytheists and monotheists. This he endeavors to prove historically in regard to the Greeks, the Romans, and the inhabitants of Western Europe. As men outgrew the fetish age, so they outgrew the polytheistic and monotheistic forms of belief. That is, they ceased to refer phenomena to the agency of supernatural beings. During the metaphysical stage, phenomena are referred to unseen causes, to occult powers, or forces, that is, to something which the senses cannot detect. This also has passed away, and men have come to recognize the great fact that there are no spiritual agencies in the universe, no efficient causes, nothing but events to be arranged according to the laws of sequence and resemblance. The order of events is invariable and necessary. What it has been in the past, it will be in the future. As this is the law of the development of the race collectively, so it is of the individual man. Everyone, in his progress from infancy to manhood, passes through these several stages, the theological, the metaphysical, and the positive. We first believe in supernatural agencies, witches, ghosts, souls, angels, etc. Then in occult causes. Then only in facts discerned by the senses. The history of the race and the experience of the individual man are thus made the broad and sure foundation of the positive philosophy. Remarks. 1. Considering that the advocates of this philosophy are a mere handful. Considering that 999 millions of the thousand millions of our race still believe in God, it is a rather violent assumption that mankind have reached the stage of positivism. It may be readily admitted that the progress of science and of Christianity has banished alchemy, astrology, witchcraft, and necromancy from enlightened portions of our race, but it has had a scarcely discernible effect in banishing belief in mind as distinct from matter, or in efficient causes, or in God. Admitting, therefore, the principle of the argument to be correct, the conclusion arrived at is contradicted by facts. 2. The principle itself, however, is a groundless assumption. There has been no such development of the race, and there is no such development of the individual man, as the argument supposes. Much less is it true, as Kant maintains, that these several methods of dealing with phenomena are antagonistic and mutually exclusive. That if we believe in spiritual agents, we cannot believe in unseen, metaphysical causes. And that if we believe in the latter, we cannot believe in the former. The fact is, the great mass of mankind, educated and uneducated, believe in both. They believe in God and mind, as well as in occult causes, such as electricity, magnetism, and other physical forces, which, in Kant's sense of the word, are metaphysical. With regard to this assumed law of progress, Professor Huxley, who is as completely emancipated from the trammels of authority as any man of science now living, says, in the first place, that Kant contradicts himself as to this fundamental principle. In proof he quotes a long passage from the Philosophy Positive, in which Kant teaches, A. As a matter of fact, the human intellect has not been invariably subjected to the law of the three states, and, therefore, the necessity of the law cannot be demonstrable a priori. B. Much of our knowledge of all kinds has not passed through the three states, and more particularly, as M. Kant is careful to point out, not through the first. C. The positive state has more or less coexisted with the theological, from the dawn of human intelligence. And, by way of completing the series of contradictions, the assertion that the three states are essentially different and even radically opposed, is met a little lower on the same page by the declaration that the metaphysical state is, at bottom, nothing but a simple general modification of the first. Men of science, he adds, are not in the habit of paying much attention to laws stated in this fashion. 192. After showing that the individual man does not pass through these several states, Professor Huxley says, what is true of the individual is, mutatis mutandis, true of the intellectual development of the species. It is absurd to say of men in a state of primitive savagery, that all their conceptions are in a theological state. 9/10 of them are eminently realistic, and as positive as ignorance and narrowness can make them. 193. Besides, it is not true that the race of men now existing on the earth, were in their primitive state fetish worshippers, or that they gradually rose to polytheism and monotheism. The reverse is true. Not only revelation, but all history and tradition, go to show that the primitive state of our race was its highest state, at least so far as religion is concerned. Monotheism was the earliest form of religion among men. To that succeeded nature worship and pantheism, and to that polytheism. It is a historical fact that monotheism was not reached by a process of development. Monotheism was first. It gradually perished from among men, except as miraculously preserved among the Hebrews, and from them diffused through the medium of, or rather, in the form of, Christianity. It extends nowhere beyond the influence, direct or indirect, of the supernatural revelation contained in the Bible. This is a fact which scientific men should not overlook in their deductions. 3. Kant was guilty of the unfairness of confining his survey to a small portion of the nations of the earth, and that the portion to which had been brought under the influence of Christianity. If the law which he sought to establish be universal and necessary, it must have operated from the beginning in India and China as well as in Europe. The millions of those regions had not reached the monotheistic, much less the metaphysical, and still less the positive stage of development. India especially furnishes a striking refutation of this theory. The Hindus are a highly intellectual race. Their language and literature are on a par with those of Greece and Rome. Their philosophers, nearly 3,000 years ago, anticipated the highest results reached by the Schellings and Hegels of our day. Yet of all the nations of the earth, the Hindus are the least materialistic, or positive, in their views of nature. With them the supernatural or spiritual is alone real. The Hindus, therefore, cannot be subject to that universal and necessary law of development which is assumed as the foundation of the positive philosophy. 4. It is of course presumptuous and idle to attempt to reason men out of their senses, or to convince them that what their very nature teaches them is true, is utterly false and untrustworthy. This, however, Kant not only attempts, but his whole system is rounded on the assumption that our nature is a delusion and a lie. That is, it is founded on the assumption that intuitive truths are false. It is intuitively true that we are free agents. This Kant denies. It is intuitively true that there is a specific and essential difference between right and wrong. This is denied. It is intuitively true that every effect has an efficient cause. This too is denied. It is intuitively true that there is a God to whom men are responsible for their character and conduct. This also is denied. Had all the intellect and all the knowledge ever possessed by men and angels been concentrated in the person of Kant, it had still been folly in him to attempt to found a system involving the denial of such truths as these. The Christian is not afraid to say one thing more. It is intuitively true, to all who have eyes to see, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that His gospel is the wisdom of God and the power of God unto salvation, and that it is absolutely impossible that any theory which is opposed to these divine intuitions can be true. Another illustration of the presumptuous character of this philosophy is found in what it teaches concerning sociology. Scientific men of all countries have long been laboriously engaged in making meteorological observations, and yet such are the number and complexity of the causes which determine the state of the weather, that no man is able to predict how the wind will blow 48 hours, much less, a year, in advance. The causes which determine human action in the individual and in society are far more complex and inscrutable than those which determine the state of the weather. Yet Kant assumes to have reduced sociology to a science, vying with mathematics in certainty. I will venture to say, is his confident assertion, that sociological science, though only established by this book, already rivals mathematical science itself, not in precision and fecundity, but in positivity and rationality.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan hard drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.